The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hola, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. We have been really bad at keeping count, so we have no idea what episode number it is.
5001.
So today I have the pleasure of introducing Michael Teodulu. He is a podiatrist, assistant professor of surgery out in Harvard Medical School. He's also the chief of foot and ankle surgery at Cambridge Health Alliance. And we reached out to Michael because there's a lot of appetite for this kind of new technique that apparently can help with the management of patients with no option CLTI. As you guys know, we are big supporters of arterialization procedures. But a few other things are kind of creeping up in the market. And one of them is this notion of distraction angiogenesis. We'll go into detail throughout the show. He'll talk to us about some technical concepts and even walk us through a case. So if you have the capacity to lay eyes on this one, I highly advise to follow through because some of the images were pretty impressive.
Yeah, I was geeking out on this one. Yeah. This was good.
Yeah. So anywho, stick around and let's talk.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Today, we are really honored to have here Dr. Michael Teodulu. And he's going to talk to us about a really interesting topic. I've heard peripherally about it and actually have very little knowledge out on it. So I'm really excited for myself to learn more about it. So Michael, why don't you give us a little bit of background of, you know, who you are, where you are, the type of work that you're doing, and how it relates to limb salvage.
Yeah, so I practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts with Cambridge Health Alliance. I'm the chief of foot and ankle surgery and serve as an assistant professor of surgery for Harvard Medical School. And my principal work is in distal lower extremity surgery, orthoplastics, limb salvage, deformity correction. And I've done a fair amount of my career in limb salvage in the diabetic arena, which keeps us all very occupied, obviously, between our vascular colleagues and podiatric colleagues and orthopedic colleagues. It's a very challenging population because it really brings all of us into the same playing field. We can't stand alone. So I've spent a lot of my career doing this and fighting the battle that we all fight with regards to preserving limbs, not only just preserving limbs, but preserving functional limbs. And I think that's something that I always qualify in the beginning of these discussions. As a surgeon, at the end of the day, I can create a closed envelope. I can create a successful tissue regeneration, but ultimately, is that a shot able foot? Is that a truly a functional foot or extremity, or is that simply a biologic prosthetic? And so as I go through this process and I think about the patient and what we put them through, I always keep in mind, what is my end? What am I going to achieve with these patients? And, you know, and it's a battle because some of these patients, I hate to say, we can take them through a lot and we can be successful surgeons, but the quality of life of the patient may not be the greatest as well by the end of it. So I spent a lot of my time in this arena, and this is kind of what got me into this kind of interesting process or an alternative look at how we can potentially achieve limb preservation in these no option type of cases.
So do you have a multidisciplinary group that you actively work with? Do you collaborate very intimately with vascular surgery?
Yeah, we do. So I have two vascular surgeons that I work very closely with. In fact, we share clinics together and they work with me we can't function independently,
right?
Especially in this patient population. We have to work hand in hand. There's no question about it. So for me, without being with a vascular surgeon, this is not something that I could do independently, of course. Yeah.
Cool. So we've talked here a fair amount in this pod about topics related to novel revascularization techniques. And I'd mentioned briefly offline that we have been very excited with some of the results and the initial data from arterializing the veins of the foot, and seems to be something that we are doing more routinely in patients with advanced medial artery calcification and pretty significant distal pedal disease, that you essentially have no options. Really through, honestly, academic forums and access to digital forums like LinkedIn and Twitter, we then get exposed to stuff that's happening in different places in the world that seems to be also another solution to this problem, right? So, when you create controlled fractures of anywhere, I guess, in your body, then there is a biological reaction that brings within angiogenesis.
Right.
And so we at least started hearing rumbles about this, and I'm going to be very, very transparent to you, Michael. I have absolutely no understanding of how this works. But we started listening to these controlled fractures, ala Lizarov, understanding that the Lizarov apparatus, it's this sort of circular external fixation device that you guys in foot and ankle surgery and podiatry surgery use a lot for, Charcot and different other things. And obviously you're very comfortable with it. But, the thought that you would create a controlled fraction on a no-option CLTI patient with the intention to create blood flow, to me, seems...
alien.
Yeah, I can't connect the dots that precisely.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly very tickled by what that means, because here's the deal. A lot of what we do with these arterializations, and I'd like to maybe down the line get to it, but a lot of these arterializations we actually do by creating these big guillotine TMAs.
Right.
And so, is in a way the osteotomy of the metatarsal bones part of what also creates a lot of neoangiogenesis at the foot level? And could that be one of the things that's happening when you do an arterialization? Meaning, could it be two things that are happening? Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like,
the acuity of the surgery, definitely. And the honesty is, I don't have a great answer. We know that with the procedure that we do, if you can do a controlled fracture, if you can do a controlled corticotomy, and you can distract this in a fashion that has been established over time, we appreciate an angiogenesis, neurogenesis. We see the response to the body in healing, and we see it locally, but we also see that response occur distally at sites that are in demand of healing as well. That's our appreciation of things. And not only that, at sites of injury, such as where there's tissue damage, we can also see effects of inflammatory response with this procedure. In fact, there's been studies and biopsies looking at macrophage response following this transport tibial procedure that we do, where we actually see control of M1, M2 macrophage response and response of improved M2 ratios to that, where we can actually see a reduction of that destructive inflammatory process. I don't know exactly how that works, but we do see that it can modify that inflammatory destructive process of healing to some of this tissue and produce an angiogenesis there. The question has always been, and even in my mind as I've done it, and the reality is it's been anecdotal, and my outcomes so far have replicated what our Chinese orthopedic colleagues have demonstrated through the years with their interest and study in this, is that somehow the body is responding to this, and we are getting a response of healing of tissue and limb preservation doing this. Can I tell you definitively that we can control where this response is occurring? I can't, but we can see it is in an area where the body is in demand, need of healing, and it seems to be occurring at our wound sites. And so we are seeing this active healing process that seems to correlate with the corticotomy and the translation that we're doing. And that's really where we're at with it.
How did you get involved with this? Like, when did you first hear about this?
And maybe even a step before that, if you don't mind, is who first started? You said you alluded to the Chinese. So can you build up a little bit more on where this came from? Who's going to put it out there? And then how you got involved and what tickled you to then say, hey, I'm going to go and learn or read and then try to do this?
Yeah, so really the first principles of this goes back to Elizaroff and our understanding. And even Elizaroff had thought about this back in the 50s in his own work, looking at tensile stress response, especially to corticotomies and healing of corticotomies and osteogenesis, and looking at the response to these corticotomies and distraction and its performance and creating distraction angiogenesis. And then in recent times, it was our Chinese orthopedic colleagues that looked at specifically initially thromboangiitis obliterans, and the initial use of TTT was on thromboangiitis obliterans and seeing if they could get a healing response simply by doing a corticotomy. And then they looked at it in diabetic foot ulcers. And in a reported study that I had reviewed, they had a population, a cohort of about 150 patients. And in that population, they had 144 patients with healed diabetic, severe diabetic foot wounds that ultimately ended up with only four digital amputations and the rest being preserved. So it was a pretty compelling work that was out there that I started to hear about and read about, and more stuff came out. And as I was starting to read about it and looking at the principles and techniques that they were doing, and then looking at things that I was doing in deformity correction and using Elizaroff principles, I said, you know, I've got a very challenging patient population. I work hand in hand with my vascular colleagues who do amazing jobs in revascularization. And I am becoming aware of deep vein arterialization. And I know I have my center up here with Mass General. And interestingly, there's one of my colleagues who's presenting next week on DVA and whether, you know, their outcomes and whether it's, you know, promise or is it still not there yet, so to speak. And regardless, we know that this is a challenging process, that these are difficult wounds to heal. But I was looking at all the other wounds attempts that we were doing, all the other things that we were looking from a regenerative standpoint. So you guys do amazing jobs creating patency and bringing blood flow down to the limb with the amazing techniques that you do, but we still need a regenerative healing process to take place. And so we have all these other approaches that we've done look at a regenerative recovery to the tissue beyond the necessary blood flow. So I started putting this all together in my own head, looking at the literature that was out there, the healing that I was seeing with regards to some of the deformity corrections and tissue healing. Interestingly, seeing anecdotally recovery of osteotomies and actually attempted bone fusions that went on to fusions after I did other procedures and employed distraction type procedures and saw the healing that occurred anecdotally, that I started to say, well, maybe there is a principle to this. Maybe there is a benefit. And that's what I said. And then I started seeing the literature that started coming over to the United States and was presented not too long ago at AOFAS, looking at the American Orthopedic Foot and Ankle Society, looking at what their outcomes with regards to doing distraction angiogenesis, again, out of the Chinese orthopedic community. I started delving into their work. And I said, well, maybe there is a place to it, but can I improve upon it? And so that's where I kind of put my spin on the approach and technique, and we can later kind of talk about that. It's not tremendously different other than the fixation that I employ and why I employ it, and there's a basis for that. But I started to employ it on some of my patients that were no option and started to see the outcomes that I'm starting to see as well.
Can you go into it? Like, so what is destruction angiogenesis? How do you do it? Why do you do it? And where, and who do you do it?
So these are, so far, I have reserved these for principally no option limb salvage type cases, but I am beginning to look at it more as an augment in recovery and regenerative in some of our more severe cases as an ancillary treatment. And so the decision is on these patients who have often undergone revascularization, and then revascularization has taken them only so far, and we still have issues with regards to tissue healing and preservation of limb. And so these are patients that I offer them what I consider to be a very pretty simple procedure to perform with limited risk. And in my hands, I think is quite elegant. So we do a tibial corticotomy, and this is done approximately in the medial face of the tibia. I do it now percutaneous, so I don't even make an incision. It's a minimally invasive procedure. So I use a burr essentially to create a 5 centimeter by 2 centimeter window. It's unicortical in the medial face of the tibia. And then I put half pins within that rectangular window. And we're using currently devices that are readily available to create an engine to translate this window laterally, so to speak. That's our lateralization of this corticotomy through an external fixator. Now, historically, and what's been done up until now, what's been recorded is most people have been utilizing a monorail external fixator. But I've been using a ring fixator. I've been attaching this engine to a ring fixator. And the reason I've done that is, one, I think it's a more stable construct. So in some of these patients, I can actually have the patients walk on that fixator very comfortably without risk of that corticotomy. It's a multiplanar fixator versus a uniplanar fixator. The other wonderful thing about a ring fixator is I can go ahead and extend that ring fixator down to a foot plate if I want to offload a wound that needs offloading from an orthoplastic. So some of the most challenging wounds that we deal with, and you know, are hind foot ankle heel wounds. These neuroischemic wounds of the heel that really require offloading as a component to this entire process. So doing my tibial corticotomy and utilizing a ring fixator with an extension to a foot plate allows me to also introduce some orthoplastics and offloading of those wounds with that technique, which I could not do with a monorail external fixator. So the corticotomy is performed. Again, we do this percutaneous without violating the skin. These procedures now take me, if I'm not utilizing an extension offloading ring in any other procedure, other procedures distally for the wound, about 20, 25 minutes in the operating room. It's a pretty straightforward approach. And we allow the corticotomy to rest for about 7 days, what we call a latency period. After that's done, we allow the patient to begin translating or distracting that osteotomy. And it's based on a Lisseroth principle. Generally, it's 1 millimeter a day, a quarter turn 4 times a day. So it's a quarter millimeter to do a gradual distraction. And I will go ahead and do that for a 2 week period. So we're basically distracting this osteotomy 1.4 centimeters through a 2 week distraction process. And then after that 2 week, we go ahead and have our patient relocate the osteotomy again over a 2 week process to bring it and seat it back into the window that we created. And then we allow it to go ahead and consolidate for 2 weeks. So essentially it's about a 7 week process that through latency, distraction, relocation, and consolidation. And then the patient's brought back into the operatory theater. The ring fixator is readily removed in a 10-15 minute process. Most of my patients then will go in some type of controlled ankle mobility boot, immobilization boot, for another 4 to 6 weeks to make sure that there's appropriate healing of the osteotomy and no problem goes on from there. What's been interesting about this is that through this process with my vascular colleagues, we've been doing pre-TTT catheter angiograms. Most of them have had a catheter angiogram with some type of intervention, whether they've had some type of stenting or revascularization. But we've also been doing, at that point, at about 8 weeks post-operative, post-TTT, a repeat angiocatheter. And interestingly, what we've been seeing is increased recruitment of flow down to these down to the extremity after the TTT. So it's suggesting to us whether we're getting some type of increased collateral flow, some type of angiogenesis, or some type of, you know, dilatory response to improve the flow. We don't know, but we're seeing increased recruitment after we complete the TTT with these post-catheter angiocatheters that we're doing. And that's where we're at with it. And then through that process, obviously, our ongoing, whatever we're doing for wound healing, tissue management, and things like that.
So how early do you, in a perfect scenario, do you expect to start seeing changes in the distal leg and in the wound to suggest?
It's amazing. We can see reperfusion quite dramatically. In a very early, within a pretty immediate process, I've done some of these procedures for colleagues of mine who've had completely dysvascular wounds that they've been going on and really have condemned them to likely BKAs. And they say, well, let Michael try a TTT on you. And we've completed the TTT and the patient's been brought back for a subsequent debridement, whatever type of potential grafting technique for closure. And they see an immense improvement in bleeding of the tissue, responsive tissue bleeding, hyperemic response that they weren't seeing before. So we see it within the distraction process. It's pretty quick, actually.
Interesting.
Wow.
Okay.
And what's the average? Do you have, first of all, have you guys measured TCPO2 changes with this?
So right now we don't do TCPO2. We're using FLIR. We do thermography. We assess, and we know that at this point, we don't have any real certified numbers that suggest it, but we do FLIR thermography to assess the reperfusion of the tissue. So we're using thermography at this point.
And when are you expecting to see a change in the image?
Generally speaking, we begin to see the change as we begin after the initial distraction. After about 2 weeks, we begin to see that early changes of increased FLIR response to the wound.
And do you have an average time? Do you have an average limb salvage rate that you can speak of, and an average wound healing rate?
Yeah. So right now, in at present, we have a sample for me of 20 patients. So it's not a large cohort. So it's pretty small.
Big.
Well, it's 20.
Probably
it's over the year.
Probably the largest in the U.S.
Yeah, I think it's probably. I don't think anyone's done more in the U.S. than me at this point.
Yeah.
We've got an N of 20. Thus far, we have preserved every limb. We've achieved wound healing on every limb. So it's matching what our Chinese were. And we've had one death, but that was for other reasons. The patient was a pretty sick individual. So at this point.
Now, this device is approved for other indications, right? This is not already FDA.
So,
like, they can't commercialize for this particular reason, and there's no CPT code for that particular reason, right?
So, what we're using is currently approved devices for any type of engine work that we do for deformity correction.
Right, right.
But for me to say I haven't and I'm not developing a device currently that we're going to the FDA that will simplify this for surgeons, we are. And we're looking to be meeting with the FDA in November to pretty much simplify this approach for surgeons to execute this corticotomy and actually more to facilitate the distraction process for surgeons. Correct.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
So I'm seeing also, you had shared with us a really cool presentation with a bunch of cases, which may actually not be a bad idea that maybe if you have it, we can share it and go over a couple of those.
You can share. Can you share from yours? I'm on my iPhone, so, but if you can share from your laptop, do you have the ability to do that?
Yeah. I can do that here in a quick second.
Or you want to transfer it over?
Yeah. I could just send it to, you can email me. Okay. But there is an image here that has a bilateral guillotine TMAs.
Right. They're the first patient that we just completed him, actually. And he's actually healed.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was looking at it because that's exactly what a lot of our DVAs look like.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you do the arterialization, you let the arterialization quote mature. And usually at about 6 or 8 weeks, we go back and we do this guillotine, and then, you know, we sometimes put a skin sub, we fill it up, and then I put in an SCSG. So I'll put a little split thickness skin graft right in this story. But I, you know, this started tickling the back of my brain with, do you think just this guillotine itself could be creating a, you know, a biological response that is generating some of that angiogenesis that you need to push it through? And could that be part of why some of these DVAs are doing that well? Could it be the aggressive management of the foot by slicing, you know, 5 metatarsal bones in the middle, right?
I mean, so the question I had on that bilateral, so I did a unilateral corticotomy on that patient with the thought, would that unilateral corticotomy produce a serum response to effect, create a bilateral effect?
Mm.
And would it, as a response systemically, create healing? But your argument could be just as valid, that could the local trauma of the bilateral guillotine amputation that I did facilitate a regenerative healing process locally,
mm-hmm,
just as well as my corticotomy? And I don't know.
Right.
That's a great question.
What's beautiful about this whole thing, it's, I find it very, very interesting. Are you going to send me that so I can share it?
Yeah, well, you have to download it.
All right. And we can edit if there's a little bit of gap time here. We could just cut it also before we publish. But.
So are you...
You sent it to my email?
Yeah, I sent it to your email. Then is this something that, first of all, is the effect, from what I'm getting, the effect that you think gets involved is not just neoangiogenesis. It seems like it's a, as you're phrasing it, a regenerative healing process. What do you mean by that?
I think it does promote angiogenesis. I think we have study that supports that it does impact local inflammatory response to areas of high demand. I think it will also promote other factors that advance wound healing in that area. In concert with the angiogenesis that we're creating. So I think there is a neogenesis that is just taking place in response to this acute injury that we're managing in a controlled fashion. And it seems, anecdotally, that seems what we're appreciating. It's interesting. I just got an article looking at, they're actually doing this, looking at cranial corticotomies for arterial injuries of the brain, and they're doing it on rat models currently and seeing the angiogenesis in those models as well, in attempt for treating vascular injuries to the brain and stroke models. So there has to be some
regional
process of healing and angiogenesis that's taking place.
It would be amazing if it was systemic and you can just do a corticotomy of the tibia to
then
brain.
It goes right to the brain, right? Right.
Yeah.
So
is this something that potentially has a role in even kind of more the no option patient, your kind of run of the mill limb salvage patient that has, you know, multi-level SFA femoral disease, but that has a significant foot wound,
yep,
because it has an additional effect on the healing potential.
I agree. Immediately, I have a neck fascia that I just said we did, and he's a diabetic, has three vessel flow, but you can see he's got a vascular healing process that's going, known history of smoking, everything else. But he's a guy that already in the back of my head, I'm thinking may benefit from a TTT because I've created an extensive wound, dorsum lateral ankle, and this may help in promoting a healing process and recovery as part of an adjunct of everything else that we're going to be doing and the principles that we do for good bone care.
Yeah. Because we definitely know that these patients have decrease in healing potential. We haven't really described the, maybe we have the how and the why, this diminished kind of wound healing potential is there. I mean, it's kind of multifactorial and it goes into a lot of things, mostly lifestyle and nutrition. But if this is a potential surgical immediate way to have some corrective effect on the kind of end organ damage, then that's amazing, right?
Yeah.
And this is going to be a really popular thing in a really short amount of time, I imagine.
Yeah, the story's yet to be told. So we're early into this. So
I don't know, Michael, if you can see.
I can see.
To put on that one case, which would be so cool. Cause, I mean, I'm pretty starstruck by it. Yeah. What you've done is incredible. And in a way, I'll be very, very honest, I feel very, very guilty because I pretty much essentially saw this patient last week. And both the foot and ankle surgeon and myself said, you know, we don't think we could do anything. I think she underwent a below the knee amputation because there was exposed calcaneus bone, a complete destruction of the mid and the hind foot. There was also infection and a bunch of other things. It may not be the same thing, but it just was like one of those that you look at it and you're like, this is going to be very difficult to reconstruct. You're going to possibly need a hemicalcinectomy. Then you're going to have to figure out how to do that, or you have to do a transfer flap, and good luck finding a plastic surgeon that wants to do that to cover, yada, yada, yada. You know how that goes. But I'd like to give it to you to just walk us through this really cool case. And
I can advance
the slides on my end.
Yeah, this was a very challenging fellow. And again, you have to have buy-in from the patient, but because as you can see, this is a very lengthy process. And along the way, there's a lot of, you know, pitfalls that can occur. But this was a nice gentleman who came in with a severe infection. And you, if you don't mind scrolling through it, so it can kind of remind me a little bit, you can go on to the next. But he did undergo multiple surgical interventions, debridements. He was no type 2 diabetic, former smoker. You can see the nature of the initial injury when he came in. It's basically a neuroischemic wound. It's a challenging area. It's the heel wound. We all know the heel wound is a devastating wound in this patient population for all the reasons. And I do reverse neural flaps. I do all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And those flaps in our diabetics can go either way, just on the nature of the beast. But somehow we've got to get a robust tissue coverage in this area. You know, just to do calcanectomy, debridements, the ability to maintain remission of wounds in these types of patients with what I call glorified healing by secondary intention is not great. So these are inherently tough wounds. So this is a neuroischemic wound that is in a very challenging location. You can see his preliminary, you know, he's got osteo of the calcaneus. You can tell by inflammatory markers and just the nature and the appearance of the wound.
You want me to go to the next? Just let me know.
Yeah, you can slide. Yeah, sure. Go ahead. X-ray findings, benign X-ray findings. You don't see a lot of cortical destruction. You can see the soft tissue envelope a little bit there where you have the defect, but you don't see aggressive destruction of the calcaneus. If you move on. MRIs, again, MRIs didn't show a lot of marrow edema or cortical destruction. You know, I hate MRIs personally. They can.
Me too.
Same here.
They can, you know, but my infectious disease doctors love them. And
I was about to say, but you know who loves them?
They love
ID it. Loves them.
Yeah. Oh, and they drive us to do things that we don't want to do. So the MRI doesn't look all that terrible either, but he did have a neuroischemic wound there, and he had an extensive infection. You can see we did an initial debridement down to bone. We had to do an IND of the medial compartment, and we got things going, got things debrided. We started negative pressure wound therapy. I'm a big installation vac person, so I do a lot of installation vacs.
With what? What do you put in it?
We just do saline.
Saline?
Yeah, we've been looking at different irrigants, but we've just fallen down onto saline, to be honest with you. And that's the truth of the matter.
You use Vash.
I use Vash, too.
What do you use?
Vash.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
How do you pronounce it? Vasha?
I say Vasha.
I say Vosh.
I love Michael, it. How do you say it?
Potato, potato, eh?
Yeah.
We can go to the next slide. And this was the gentleman's arteria. We did a CTA on him. And you can see also what came back. Lots from bone biopsy of calcaneus, some multi-organism growth. And interestingly, he had candida, so we had to deal with yeast on top of it. So where I practice in Boston, let me give you a little background. Cambridge Health Alliance is between Boston Medical Center, my institution, is the other public hospital system. We have a very large Haitian Creole, Portuguese, Brazilian, and Spanish population. I practice right in the backyard of Harvard, and the patient population I treat, you would never believe, lives in the back of Harvard University. So we treat a very underserved population, and so we see a lot of things that come directly off the airplane. And I think this gentleman was one of those cases that comes right into our emergency department. And I treat conditions that I see polio that we don't see in our in case. Anyways, so we went again and did debridement. I use a lot of offloader frames, particularly in the heel. I think I'm very aggressive with offloader frames to protect this area. We did our debridements. We did our osteotomy of calcaneus, debridement, wound closure. You know, never really had a leukocytosis. Covered him with antibiotics, worked with our infectious disease doctors. And then he went to stir.
Why, and part of my ignorance, why the osteotomy of the calcaneus?
No, osteotomy. It's osteotomy. We did a partial calcaneectomy, essentially. So then these cases, I do, if I think I have in situ osteomyelitis, I'll do a partial calcaneectomy. And then I do a silo technique utilizing calcium sulfate. And I will put a vancomycin or a vancgent. Impregnation into the calcaneus for drug elution into the calcaneus.
Okay. And are those absorbable? Do you leave
them? Yeah, calcium sulfate is purely absorbable. Yeah. So they do tend to drain a lot. That's their problem that everybody freaks out because.
And the calcium. Manage that by the wound vac or?
Yeah, wound vac, drainage, local wound care, and things like that.
Okay.
So he went to stir, who then transferred him out because he was having some congestive heart failure issues. So he's obviously a sick fellow that went to outside institution, immediately suggested what you said, BKA. There's not much we can do for this fellow. They looked at this and family was adamant not to have a BKA.
Yeah.
So they said, go back to Theodulu. He's kind of a crazy bird. He'll try it. You can see the partial calcaneectomy that's already been done and we've got the offloader frame and you can see the wound that we're dealing with.
Yeah, that's significant.
That is significant. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're just managing this with negative pressure.
Negative pressure, local debridements. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I'm trying to figure out what kind of closure that I can do for this fellow. In fact, I did attempt a distally based lateral plantar artery pedicle flap on him.
When you have that defect, what are you thinking? Are you thinking you're going to bridge it with negative pressure until you have more contracture and a smaller wound? Or are you thinking, oh, this is going to need a flap and I'm just planning when I'm going to put it on my schedule?
Yeah, I'm really trying. If I can think I can get a flap done, I'd like to get these things closed over. And I try to get it as robust a wound closure as I can. Because to get this to contract and then think that a split thickness skin graft or anything like that will be sustainable for this patient, he'll be back in my clinic within 6 months with breakdown. And so I really try to get some type of either distally based flap or locally based flap in that area to give it the best possibility. Now, I try to get these closed as much as I possibly can and contract it and then try to get some type of robust flap over that region. And so that's what we were trying to do with this fellow, get things debrided, cleaned up. And then I had a lateral plantar artery to work with. And so we did a rotational, it was a pedicle flap with a lateral plantar artery to rotate into that. And then I used a bilayer wound matrix to facilitate some of the closure. on that region. Unfortunately for me, you know, and these happen with these compromised patients, that flap didn't take too well. Maybe for lots of reasons, it went okay at first, but the flap didn't do well.
So are we seeing here? When you see this, I see obviously ischemic tissue. There's some gauze there covering what?
That was where the defect. So I think the gauze is where I rotated the flap down from.
Okay.
That was a flap that was coming distally based, rotating down plantarly over the calcaneus. And that was the donor site, and that's where we put our bilayer. And I think the gauze, from what I can see, is covering the bilayer closure of our harvest site of the flap.
Okay.
I'm kind of seeing it there. So yeah, so that was our flap coverage. And you can see, and the basic principle always is that the most distal portion of our flap tends to necrose from our pedicle. And it did on this fellow, unfortunately.
But you're not, at this point, you have some positive expectations on how this is going to
progress? No, these are challenging. And throughout this process, we're telling the patient, you know, we're going at this. They want to try to save the limb, but throughout this entire process, there is known risk that, you know, this may not be a salvageable limb. And he was already told to have a BKA, but they said, let's go, you know, let's try it. Let's keep going for it. Yeah. So I think this is where the idea started to come in. And this is kind of where our wound was. You can see where we're at. Can we now consider performance of our distraction angiogenesis?
Okay.
So thus far you hadn't done it.
Nope, we hadn't done the distraction angiogenesis yet.
So here's where you decide, okay, let's go ahead and do it.
This is where we started saying, can we goal is limb salvage? What now? Microvascular disease, continue local wound care, repeat INDs, OR, adjunct procedure. And this is where the concept of distraction angiogenesis. And so this is where we did the tibial corticotomy. Mm-hmm. Continued good vigilant local wound care. That never changes. We talked about our latency period. We've kind of toyed a little bit. If you go back a slide, we changed our recipes back and forth to see what works. If you look carefully, we did a cortical distraction for 7 days, reverser 7 days. We've tried a 2-week distraction period with a 2-week relocation period. We've also tried this principle of opening the drawer, closing the drawer, opening the drawer, closing the drawer to see if that translation, relocation would have any different effect in healing. I don't believe we've seen that in the few patients we've done that. So I don't think that recipe changes anything. I think just the distraction process can be done 2 weeks with relocation after 2 weeks. But we tried that opening and closing drawer principle. And then we went ahead and reversed it, put the patient back. Patient was on systemic antimicrobials, culture-based. And we went on, kind of see where our calcaneotomy is, where we were at. Did a repeat arterial duplex. And he did develop some distal occlusive process to the lesser toes. And we weren't certain, and we started looking at literature in the Chinese literature, whether this corticotomy is known to create any type of embolic phenomenon. And we couldn't really find anything in that regard. But we did appreciate that with arterial duplex, that there was a complete distal occlusion of the posterior tibula. Was there a concern for microembolization? It remained pretty...
Wouldn't that be because of potentially of your flap?
Yeah, it could have been from the flap. But the flap was distally based. It wasn't proximal at the posterior tip. Could it have occluded there?
Probably affected the outflow.
Yeah, it could have affected the outflow. Yeah. So we ended up doing some partial amputations. I use a monorail to close down when I do central ray amputations to help close down the defect. We still have that plantar heel wound that you can see.
Would you recommend that monorail instead of kind of like the, sometimes I do like the lobster foot.
Yeah, I love this monorail. Christopher Bibbo has published on this technique. I love it because it reduces the tension, brings the metatarsals, takes the tension off the soft tissue envelopes, an easy fixator to put on into those metatarsals, and allows a nice reduction during the healing process. So it's a nice little technique, especially when you take central rays away. So yeah, I like that little technique. And we did some repeat debridements. And as we went on, we started seeing granulation and healing. Ultimately came back and put a split thickness skin graft on the, as we saw a good healthy granular bed.
Mm-hmm. You want to go forward, Michael?
Yep.
And I just saw him in the clinic this week. He's shot able, preserved foot. Yeah, and I think for us, this was a good save.
That's amazing when you see this.
That's amazing work. That's really amazing.
That is
but
crazy.
It was crazy good. It was a heck of a process. And as you can tell, as you say, throughout this entire, you know, it was tenuous, you know, in limb salvage, but the patient was committed to it. He had an amazing attitude towards it, which is most of the battle. If you can get a patient vested into saving their limb, as you know, so many of them just sit there for us and say, save it for me, and don't vest themselves into it too. But he was completely vested into the process and had an infrastructure to support him as well. So that's a huge part of it.
Yep.
Huge network. Part of it.
I always say network and personal vesting.
Yeah.
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 Well, look, Michael, this has been amazing. I really want to congratulate you and your team for pushing forward. I understand myself a lot more. I have a lot more questions at the same time, but that's good. It's tickled, you know, the intellectual curiosity, and I certainly. Look forward to listening more from what your results are and learning even more, because, you know, there could be another tool here.
This is super interesting. Are you presenting your data or doing any talks in any meetings in the immediate future that our listeners can go?
So we're being cautious about it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a good cohort, good sample size. I still think it's very limited. It's still in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I think I'm excited what I personally have seen, but I have still the same questions that I know are floating through your mind as well.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable doing it because I'm doing it in the right cases, knowing that some of these patients really have no option.
Mm-hmm.
I'm comfortable with the technique that I'm employing because I use XFix a lot for other reasons. And it's, for me, a relatively benign procedure to do. And as long as the patient's willing to accept the procedure. So I say all this to you because I do still have questions. And I want to make sure before I put everything out there that I don't tell people, yeah, this is the answer. And and so I'm cautious still. How's that?
Let me tell you, when we started doing DVAs, we had all the questions. And we did them. Yeah. You know, because there's you know, you can't deny the effect. You can't deny what your eyes are seeing.
Yeah.
And how about like anybody that's interested in learning this? So say Brian Lipo, which was a podiatrist that works with Miguel.
Brian reached out to me. He's like, what do you think? I was like, I don't think anything. You know? I don't think anything, because this would be up your alley. You'd have to do everything. I don't know that I can help you in any way other than support the efforts, but...
Where can those people that are interested be get more information, get oriented?
Maybe they're welcome to reach out to me. I've actually had one surgeon come up and visit me up here in Cambridge and watch me employ the technique. So you're more than welcome with Brian to share my email or my contact if he has interest, and he can reach out to me.
Well.
I'm not in a position right now, because you can tell, to suggest that where we stand with my developing device. What I'm using now is available to anyone.
Yeah.
Anyone with a thought process and knowing the Lizaroff and engine technique, could potentially create their own distraction device. So be open and honest. There's nothing patented about that.
It's the same with LimFlow, right? You could do an off-the-shelf arterialization,
right?
Or you can use the device that's FDA approved. So at the end of the day, one thing we talk here about politics and economics and business, and this is for entertainment purposes. So anybody out there, go study and get certified and do. But this is for you to open your intellectual curiosity. And understand that there are people trying to push because there are other people that need that help. And so, Michael, we commend you for your work. We appreciate your time on a weekend sharing with us. And I'm sure a lot of people out there are going to also enjoy this chat.
Okay. Truly a pleasure and honor to speak to both of you as well.
All right, buddy.
All right. Have a good one.
Be in touch. Bye-bye. Okay. Bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.